As recently as last week, attorneys were telling me that the Comstock Act would not come up. It was not relevant. It wasn't anything to worry about. And I had, you know, longtime reproductive health advocates, including people who'd like worked on the original approval of mifepristone, saying like, we've got to clean up our Comstock Act situation because they're coming. You know, like whether or not it comes up in court, they're coming.
Thank you to our patrons. We are deeply grateful for your support and couldn't do any of this without you. If you're not a patron and you'd like to support the show, head to patreon.com/deathpanelpod. As a thank you, patrons get access to a second weekly bonus episode that comes out in the patron feed every Monday. Becoming a patron also gets you access to the entire back catalog of bonus episodes, and we are entirely supported by our listeners. No ads, no grants, just a small team bringing you this project. And if you'd like to help us out a little bit more, share the show with your friends, post about your favorite episodes, pick up copies of Health Communism and A Short History of Trans Misogyny at your local bookstore, or request them at your local library, and follow us at deathpanel_. So I am here today with my co-host, Abby Cardis.
Hello.
And the two of us are joined by returning guest and dear friend of the panel, Melissa Gira Grant. Melissa is a journalist, author, and documentary filmmaker who is a staff writer at The New Republic. She tirelessly covers the intersections of gender, sexuality, race, health, reproductive justice, and the so-called law. She is the author of the book Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work, published by Verso, and is working on her next book, which is forthcoming from Little Brown, called A Woman is Against the Law, Sex, Race, and the Limits of Justice in America. Welcome back to the Death Panel, Melissa. Always so nice to have you on.
It's so great to have this conversation with you guys in the heat of it. So I appreciate you having me on.
I mean, I've been dreading these oral arguments that we're about to talk about today. And one of the reasons why it felt perhaps only a small percentage less dreadful than I was anticipating was knowing that we were going to get to talk to you right afterwards and just process it all together.
So needed.
Yeah, this is definitely process. The tone is processing.
Yes, yes. That is the vibe for today. That's the theme. And Melissa, just thank you so much for coming back on the show today to help us sort of talk through what played out during oral arguments that took place earlier this week in the Supreme Court surrounding a case that could severely limit access to the abortion medication mifepristone. This case is called, well, it's two cases, but so the top line name that's easiest to use as reference is the U.S. Food and Drug Administration versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. Melissa, you were there in the room for the oral arguments. I can't wait to hear what it was like. And you also wrote a rapid response piece published in The New Republic called Two Supreme Court Justices Favor Zombie Law from 1873 to Ban Abortion. So as longtime listeners may be guessing, the Comstock Act comes up, and this is now a topic that you've been helping us cover on Death Panel for years now, namely how conservatives are using administrative law as a weapon against reproductive rights in the United States. We've tracked and analyzed this from so many different angles, from state-level attacks on trans life to hyper-localized resistance, like our episode about libraries with Melissa and Mariam Kaba. But perhaps most importantly and frustratingly, a major focus of our discussions has been about how this is playing out at the level of the Supreme Court, and also the central role that a, I'd say, formerly obscure 19th century law known as the Comstock Act is playing out amongst it all, which is, again, coming to a head in the Supreme Court's oral arguments that happened earlier this week. It's ultimately a very complicated case, but it basically boils down to this group, the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, a very recently formed group claiming to represent anti-abortion doctors, joined by a few other plaintiffs like the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. I think the Christian Dental Association, some others. Yes. They've all joined together as plaintiffs against the federal agency, the Food and Drug Administration, essentially challenging the FDA's approval of mifepristone and attempting to use recent updates to the drug's safety precautions and distribution guidelines to access via telemedicine, changing who can prescribe it, to attempt to roll back these expansions to its use nationwide, restricting access to mifepristone. But basically, the argument was that FDA was actually wrong to approve it in the first place, and that recent shifts that have allowed it to be prescribed via telemedicine violate the Comstock Act. So we're basically going to walk through three things today. First, we're going to get into the case itself. You know, what is at play? What went down earlier this week in the oral arguments? And then after, I'd love for us to just focus on two specific areas of the oral arguments, the mention of the Comstock Act and the broader implications there. And then also the argument that is basically being made here regarding scientific evidence, the FDA, regulatory authority, et cetera. So to start us off, Melissa, you've done such excellent reporting on this and have been following it so closely. Can you set us up here and set up the focus on the Comstock Act and why it's a big deal? You know, I think for listeners who might not be caught up, it's just important to start from the top and then situate it within what is actually going on in the bigger picture.
No, absolutely. And thank you for that very kind words. This feels like I had to look back this morning. I think the first time we did a total Comstock Act deep dive together was with Jules in June 2023.
It was actually April.
April 2023? Okay. You know what? I was looking at the Unlocked episode. You're right. We did it in April.
Yes. We unlocked it June 15th, and I think it was April 22nd.
That's right. So basically a year of this. And, yeah. And that episode was pegged to the first time the Supreme Court got a crack at this case. Mm-hmm. At that time, they issued a stay in a lower court decision that allowed mifepristone to sort of remain at the status quo availability, which is, it's really worth just saying this very, very at the very front before we get into some of the more depressing stuff. Mifepristone is still available. Mifepristone is still safe. As you know, activists have been saying, like, the court is not who determines our medicine. People will continue to use mifepristone to self-manage their own abortion. And the use of mifepristone has just, it's now with misoprostol the most common form of abortion in the United States. It was trending that way even before the Dobbs decision in 2022. And I think that that is part of the reason this case is so significant for anti-abortion groups, sort of trying to figure out what they're doing without Roe, you know, like what's sort of like the next horizon for them. And there's something I think about medication abortion, if folks aren't familiar with just the practice of taking it, you know, it allows you to, in the privacy of your own home or with your friends or whoever you want for your own support network, you don't need to go to a doctor. You don't even necessarily need to present in person for anything to get a prescription for it. People also, you know, obtain it informally through support networks. And it essentially creates a situation where, as these doctors, quote unquote doctors, are complaining, if you did have complications from taking mifepristone and you did need to seek medical care, you would not necessarily need to tell them that you had taken it. You know, the complications that you are facing and the way that your symptoms would present would essentially look similar to a miscarriage. And that's really important right now in a situation where, you know, we have total bans on abortion in many U.S. states, if not more than half at this point. You know, access has already been severely limited for years prior to losing Roe. And I think mifepristone really pisses these quote unquote doctors off because it goes above and beyond Roe in some ways, like the degree of reproductive autonomy it gives people. And then when they have to, if they have to interact with the formal medical system, you know, there's no way for their physicians or whoever it is they encounter in the ER to know that they had an abortion, which is really important when abortion is criminalized. And I think that's actually like the kind of the heart of this case and why it's also a little bit different than the terms of Roe v. Wade or other, you know, high profile abortion cases, is this is in some ways like a very new reality that we have been living in and that they find intolerable that people have this degree of control over their own abortions. So just to sort of lay that out, the quote unquote doctors, I keep saying quote unquote, not because they're not doctors, but because some of them are like dentists mm-hmm. and people who may have a medical license, but haven't practiced medicine, you know, since before mifepristone was made available by the FDA in some cases.
Homeopaths against.
Yes. I'm definitely going to be going to the dentist for my miscarriage. That's, you know.
I mean, whenever I have any sort of issues with the internal parts of my body, the first thing I do is call my dentist.
Absolutely. They're so easy to see and just so personable.
They're so affordable. Yeah.
Yeah. Love it. Love the insurance. So sorry. Our horrible American healthcare system is like always part of the backdrop of every one of these episodes, but here it's just like particularly laughable with like this group that has called themselves the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. You know, they're the originating plaintiffs in this. And the group is barely also a group, I think it's worth saying. Like a lot about the way that this case came together is so representative of the current state of the judiciary in the United States, the complete dark money Christian nationalist capture of the judiciary, their ability to like essentially manufacture plaintiffs. We've talked about them before on the show in the context, I think, of the 303 Creative case last year. Where a Christian nationalist law group called Alliance Defending Freedom brought a very speculative case before the court saying, you know, our client, as a Christian, it would violate her deeply held religious beliefs if she was asked to make a wedding website for a same-sex couple, but she's never actually been asked and she doesn't even make wedding websites. And they were able to, like, the premise of our justice system, theoretically, is that the court has to actually deal with a real controversy with real stakes and real injuries. And if 303 sounded like it was built on fake controversies and non-existent injuries and speculation about things that hadn't even happened yet, this one is even more extreme. You know, none of the plaintiffs in this case are reporting that they had a patient who took mifepristone, had an adverse experience, and that that harmed them in some way, which is also sort of like preposterous that like the physician is the one who's harmed here. Like, wouldn't you think if there were adverse experiences happening at the rate at which they claim they are with mifepristone, that a patient perhaps would be the person to bring this suit? Right. But it's not about that. Like this claim here, and the reason why I sort of front loaded everything about the realities of mifepristone is that the claim here is that physicians are harmed by patients self-managing their abortion. That language doesn't, you know, appear in their arguments. It's certainly not anything that happened that played out in court, you know, explicitly earlier this week. But the thinking here is that physicians have a stake in the FDA's approval of mifepristone, which I think is true. But they want to overrule what the FDA has already done and has been FDA practice since the year 2000 when mifepristone was first made available. You know, the only reason that this case is happening now is because we no longer have Roe. Like, I think the other tricky thing about this case is like, well, wait a minute, this has been available since the year 2000. Why is it coming now? What has changed? Why you guys? Like, all of these are reasonable questions. And I think there's a level at which the case is sort of playing out on a more vibes-based level than a law-based level, that also makes it sort of hard to wrap your head around. So, you know, the reality that these plaintiffs oppose is the one in which, you know, people have actually been able to continue to access abortion with or without Roe, with or without the involvement of physicians who may oppose their choices to manage their own abortion, their own choice to remain pregnant or not. They, in a way, it's really, it feels so of an era of like, you know, the physicians trying to take control of pregnancy, period, by like carving out space for themselves and, you know, describing pregnancy as this like super dangerous thing that elite doctors have to have control over and, you know, fuck those midwives or anybody else. Like,
yeah, pregnancy is a disease state.
But then they also are so pissed off at the idea that pregnancy is a health issue. So one of their things that they say to the FDA is like, you consider pregnancy a sickness. And it's like, I don't even know where that's coming from other than to sort of like bring this Christian nationalist rhetoric of the pure natural state of pregnancy that like all women should be in at all times. It's this very bizarre, but totally normal for our political moment collapse of like, we're about medicine and science and the FDA is harming women. But also we're all about women as these pure vessels of reproduction that just happens naturally through the will of God.
Yeah. And you know, nothing ever goes wrong with a pregnancy requiring medical attention.
Not at all. I didn't even get to a lot, but you know, I think maybe that's like a decent seedbed to lay. And then if you guys want to ask me some more questions about what to elaborate, because this case is truly a mess and the justices were not shy about saying that.
No, it's a messy knot. And even the kind of degree of technicality on which this made it to the Supreme Court is rather extreme, because so mifepristone, as we've been talking about, was approved by the FDA in the year 2000, right? And there is a statute of limitations and a point at which you have lost your opportunity to challenge that regulatory action. And that period is 6 years. So by 2006, essentially, the kind of grounds that they had to even challenge what they were really going for in this case, to say that that decision to pass that approval in 2000, you know, was wrong, they actually couldn't technically go after that decision, right? Like, they lost that opportunity in 2006. So what's been leveraged here is these additional regulatory changes, right, that have elaborated upon and updated the base of evidence that supports, you know, the documentation on file in the administrative state in the FDA supporting mifepristone's access, you know. And it essentially, this whole case relies on both technicalities, fabricated harm, you know, the kind of extreme hypothetical upon hypothetical that builds to create some kind of like probabilistic frame that could theoretically work. And ultimately, what we're talking about is how also medicalization is being leveraged here to kind of collapse this whole argument and collapse so many sort of complicated harms of the healthcare industry, right? To very cynically support this predetermined goal of attacking reproductive rights. And so ultimately, it's one of those frustrating examples where, because the arena is also the court, right, you have a lot of people who kind of play along, like, because so much of the performance of the Supreme Court is playing technicalities and winning kind of this theoretical, like, debate society version of real life. It really shows, I think, the true shallow pool of the Supreme Court's credibility, right? Because this whole performance that this entire framework that we're discussing and going to get into way more detail on in a moment, that the fact that this is a kind of legitimate question for the court to be entertaining, the fact that that's treated as legitimate in and of itself is part of the thing that normalizes inclusion of the even more bizarre, like the Comstock Act.
Yeah, the court seemed aware of this also, which I think threw some people off, you know, to have the justices asking questions that were like, well, why do you guys even have standing to bring this to us? What is the controversy? if you guys have standing to bring this, then who doesn't? Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's Clarence Thomas wasn't suggesting that anybody who feels harmed by the American medical system has standing to bring a case to the Supreme Court. you know, that is an interesting thought experiment. But I think, you know, the vibe at oral argument was very much like, we know this case before us, speaking for the conservative justices, the anti-abortion justices, we know this case before us is deeply sketchy, based on speculation, has no real injured party. Your arguments are trash. Can you, in this space, which is what oral argument is really used for, can you give us the ammunition we need to go back and amongst ourselves as the justices come to a decision? Like, if I go with the argument that you guys are bringing me, I will seem ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you some leading questions in this hour and a half long oral argument that will allow me to sit across from Justice Sotomayor, or allow me to sit across from Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson and like make a better case than you could. Mm-hmm. Like, that also sort of speaks to this moment that we're in, where like, I think on the Christian right and amongst overt Christian nationalists who, you know, have long departed from anything that looks like democratic norms or the rule of law, I don't think that that's debatable anymore, even though it's still being debated. I think the idea that what's going on here is purely performance for the sake of getting to the outcome that we all know we want. And the debate society kind of aspect of it too, is like, that protects those quote unquote physicians from having to say what they really want, which is they want a reality in which anybody presenting to them for medical care has to disclose if they had an abortion. Mm-hmm. That's what they want. And mm-hmm. and that the structure of our, you know, constitutional order and our legal system, this isn't unusual to this case that like you can't talk about like the actual controversy and instead have to talk about all of these things sort of off to the side about, mm-hmm. you know, what's the right process.
Article 3. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
I feel like that's really where some of the, you know, because it's already, we were chatting just before we started recording about some of the coverage of this and how it really feels to me like kind of a repeat of the coverage of the SB 8 Supreme Court decision, which happened mm-hmm. before the Dobbs decision. And mm-hmm. there was a lot of like very optimistic coverage that was like, oh, you see, like this case was so procedurally silly. It's fine. You know what I mean? Like this seems to signal that the justices, like, you know, maybe they're not going to reverse Roe v. Wade. And I feel like this is kind of this preoccupation with like the procedural aspects of this particular case, I think is feeding into some of that rosy coverage today. But on this point that you're making about the kind of theater of all of this, like the charade that's going on, and it was really egregious. I mean, you had these justices, they're basically pulling their tits out to like breastfeed Erin Hawley, you know what I mean, the questions that she ought to be asking them, you know, like there was an exchange with like Neil Gorsuch that was so astounding where he was just kind of explaining to her the questions that she was being asked to try to set her up to answer them more specifically. And, you know, she was just kind of rotely repeating the same things over and over again about, oh, this is an emergency situation. And you don't know, you know, as a fucking dentist, you don't know when you scrub in to an emergency DNC.
I know.
Yeah. I was losing my mind every time they said scrub in.
I was like, what are you talking about? Erin Hawley,
the attorney for Alliance Defending Freedom and the Fake Doctor Group. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so that's kind of what I want you to talk about, Melissa, a little mm-hmm. bit, because for people that maybe aren't familiar with the Byzantine like twists and turns that this case is taking procedurally or even what's really going on here, I'm wondering if you can maybe clarify like what exactly the harm is that these petitioners are, you know, these quote unquote doctors are claiming that they face as a result of this. And mm-hmm. If you could talk about that both from kind of the like on its face, ridiculous sort of like legal level, but also the vibes based level, because I feel like there's a lot that's going on kind mm-hmm. of like ideologically. And this is kind of where I was going with my comment, I guess, about the optimistic coverage, you know, like
yeah,
the really yeah. dark, like psychic forces at play here are getting sort of glossed away in the procedural coverage, which is, you know, important. But yeah, I'm just wondering if you can talk about that, maybe for people who don't know, just super clearly, like, what are these doctors claiming they're being harmed by?
Yeah. So this particular group that's the lead plaintiff in the case, Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, which, you know, is a group of groups. So there's five different anti-abortion medical groups, including the Christian Medical Dentists Association, who we keep harping on. I'm sorry, dentists who are listening. It's just like, this is just yeah. preposterous. The dentists have a stake in this. It's actually really shocking seeing the like thousands of members that these groups have, and that like some of us may actually be seeing them as patients and have no idea. That's something that sat with me a lot going through yeah. this case. You know, so there's doctors who are openly, nakedly, unapologetically anti-abortion involved in this case. But, you know, you can't say like FDA should never have approved mifepristone because I oppose abortion. Mm-hmm. They have to get into this sort of convoluted chain of possible events that give them a stake in the FDA's approval of mifepristone. So one of the disputes is that mifepristone can be dispensed now through telehealth after some changes that were made to FDA regulations. I think there were some in 2021 at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, and then they were like further elaborated and institutionalized in 2023 that allow you to, you know, essentially like do a telehealth or video appointment with a medical provider and then have pills mailed to you. That activity, that like completely normative medical activity, is described by these doctors as mail order chemical abortion. Mm-hmm. So they've had
cool.
this sort of, yeah, right. They had to create this like semi-fictional version of what is even happening here, then cast danger and doubt on that, you know, mifepristone, like I'm no fan of the FDA being like, well, trust us, trust the science for many reasons. But in this case, they're like, no, but like literally we have 22 years of history here to point to in terms of like what kinds of adverse events that there are. We have like real world data to say this is like how rarely there are adverse events. At one point in oral argument, Aaron Hawley, the attorney for Alliance Defending Freedom, who's representing Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, Alliance Defending Freedom's the Christian nationalist law group that's brought other manufactured cases to the court. She's also the wife of Senator Josh Hawley, maybe most famous for raising his fist crossing the street during the insurrection on January 6th. Yeah, total clown, both lawyers.
Naturally.
You know, yeah. Aaron Hawley at one point misspoke and talked about tens of thousands of adverse events and then had to like wrap it up and be like, dozens.
Just two orders of magnitude. No big fucking deal.
Yeah. just amateur hour shit. I think there's this like fantasy that the Christian right is full of these really smart legal minds among some people who are like super smart. And that's how they've managed to manipulate the gears of the legal system. But a lot of it is, as you were saying, Abby, like this vibes-based sort of confidence game. Of like, well, I know and you know that what this is really about is getting rid of mifepristone, and look at my sophisticated legal argument that I've invented to do that without having to actually acknowledge that that's what I'm trying to do. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the fantasy here, is that like there's this thing that's happening called mail order chemical abortion that doctors oppose because, and this is going to sound ridiculous, but like go with me, listeners, somebody might obtain mifepristone from, you know, another medical provider through prescription, take it, need to get medical treatment because they're one of the people who had an adverse experience that was severe enough that they sought medical treatment. And when they do that, they encounter a physician who does not want to be, as Aaron Hawley said, complicit in an elective abortion. And therefore, that doctor has been harmed. Mm-hmm. Now, the justices like Kagan and Jackson and Sotomayor, even to an extent, Gorsuch, surprising people, you know, pushed back on this. And we're like, well, do you have any examples of physicians who had this happen to them? Because we don't see that in your case. No. Mm-hmm. Okay. You don't have an actual story to tell us about this event happening. Also, like, physicians already have protection, quote unquote protection, from this kind of incident through having, you know, conscience clauses and exceptions where like they can in some hospital systems say, like, I refuse to prescribe birth control, or I refuse to do a DNC for someone who's had an abortion. And the FDA attorneys, you know, emphasized that and kind of fell back on that at repeated times to say, like, look, like, even if they were opposed to abortion and didn't want to be, quote unquote, complicit in an abortion by performing a DNC, which like that's just like a whole chain of events to have to just like swallow. Right. But like giving somebody life saving medical treatment is being complicit in an abortion.
Yeah.
And also that there's anything wrong with being, quote unquote, complicit in an abortion. You know, it reminds me a lot of the kind of like religious freedom to discriminate type arguments that we also see from these Christian right and Christian nationalist law projects that frame anti-discrimination laws as violating their religious freedom, because if they're forbidden from discriminating against queer and trans people, then like that's violating their religious beliefs. It's much closer to that kind of argument, but you can't pin that on the FDA, right? Mm-hmm. So they had to make it about, well, the FDA is the responsible party here, because they made a mistake in the way that they allow people to have access to this drug. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is, I don't think we've said this explicitly, like to allow a group of private citizens to use the legal system to overrule FDA regulations is uncharted territory in the extreme.
Yep. Yeah.
And so even like getting the court to accept that premise, one of the things the FDA attorneys were saying is like, look, we're here to address safety and efficacy. Congress has endowed us, empowered us to do that. And for the courts and also these groups to interfere in that is essentially overruling the will of the people who, you know, constituted the way the FDA works in this way. I mean, I think that's like a somewhat rosy picture of like the degree to which people have a say of what's going on at the FDA. Putting that aside, it is extraordinary to say that a panel of judges should be able to decide that certain FDA regulations should be abandoned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, the kind of framing that actually the explicit wording that Holly uses is complicity harm. And when she's being pressed to kind of give some sort of indication as to like potentially what the size of the group of doctors might be that are being harmed, right? Because this is like the kind of hypothetical that she sets up. And so at a certain point, you know, she's being pushed on this, and I think it's Jackson and Kagan are asking, you know, essentially like how many doctors, how many procedures would this be? And there's a really interesting sort of through line actually that runs parallel to all of this rhetoric where, you know, we're seeing these lawyers also play really fast and loose with statistics and mm-hmm. with analysis of research and in the communication of like the implications of research. And so what I found so interesting is, you know, she goes through this whole sort of ringer where Holly's being asked to kind of give some sort of indication where to look for evidence for how many doctors might be in this hypothetical group of people who could be harmed by complicity, who would not be subject to this exemption that pre-exists, right? And, you know, she just runs through this kind of framework where she's like, okay, so the FDA acknowledges they have evidence that states this, and we've got, you know, this small proportion of that group of people. And it just, I mean, Abby, is there a kind of like term of art for for the specific way that she's misrepresenting kind of the scale, just using numbers actually as a rhetorical cudgel, not actually sort of conveying meaning with the description and the use of the data in a lot of the arguments that Holly makes?
Well, I don't know if there's a word for it beyond just like prevaricating, you know, just lying kind of. I feel like that's
lying with numbers.
Really, yeah. Well, and it's not even lying with numbers. It's like the FDA basically says, and, you know, I think that they have very good reason for this, that, you know, the safety profile of mifepristone is basically similar to like ibuprofen, you know, to like Advil. And one of the things that they are taking issue with from like a data perspective is that the FDA no longer requires reporting about like non-fatal adverse events or something. Now, I can't remember the exact details, but basically the FDA is like, okay, you know, we know that some number of people go to the emergency room. It turns out that most of them are probably just kind of bleeding heavily and want to make sure that everything is okay, you know, and get sent home basically with like no intervention really being necessary. So I think from the FDA's perspective, it's like, okay, like these aren't adverse events. Like this is just, you know, this isn't necessary to evaluate, you know, the safety and efficacy of these drugs. And it's been interesting to me the way that this group of quote unquote doctors, the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine or whatever, has kind of inflated that into a major concern. And they're like, oh, well, the FDA is simply using emergency room doctors as a backstop, you know, for these incredibly yes. risky and dangerous drugs that are causing all these problems like all over the country. And I mean, obviously it's just bogus, you know, it's just bogus. It's just taking, it's kind of cherry picking, you know, and it's interesting because I read, I think the initial petition or part of it. And in that, you know, they're really taking issue with the fact that the FDA is basing like some of its claims about safety on studies that it conducted itself or, you know, that were conducted elsewhere. It's basing some of these claims on the like adverse events reporting system and data that comes from that, you know, and technicalities about like how that data is collected. But it kind of struck me like the big thing here is they are using the mere existence of like healthcare utilization around mm-hmm. self-managed yes. abortion as evidence that like the FDA is playing fast and loose with how it's like allowing people to access these right. drugs and that, you know, these drugs are incredibly risky and this is like putting all this burden on, yeah, on these poor like emergency room doctors. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there is. It's like it's an interesting thing. One thing I feel confident saying is that like there's not like a respect for the scientific process. You know what I mean? Like there's not a lot of like evidence the evidence here is really being used just as like a kind of a cudgel, I feel. And I don't know, but I do think it's kind of interesting because in this argument about like the backstop of the emergency room, it does make me, it makes me like wince a little bit. And maybe you can tell me that I don't need to worry about this, but you know, it is true that some number of people self-manage abortion with these drugs that are very safe and, you know, might need to seek medical attention. And what really has struck me in the oral arguments yesterday and in the original petition was like, you know, there's, they talk a lot about this conscience harm, but these arguments about evidence seem to really go to like another type of harm that they're getting towards, which seems to me very sinister in the context of reproductive health care access in this country right now, which is that they're saying, oh, well, like, you know, our doctors are harmed because people come in bleeding from a self-managed abortion. And that takes time away. You know, not only does that harm our consciences, that we have to save the lives of these evil fucking sluts, you know what I mean, that are like showing up to the emergency room, but it also like takes time away, you know, labor, like legitimate, like labor and delivery, real labor and delivery. And the thing that I just can't get out of my head is that they're playing fast and loose with this evidence, but they're trying to do it. They're just kind of throwing spaghetti at the wall, you know, throwing numbers at the wall. And they're trying to do it to morally distinguish events that are like biologically not distinguishable. Yes. You know what I mean? Yes. Like whether you're bleeding from a period, a miscarriage, you know what I mean? Like anything like that, you can't really tell. And I feel I'm starting to get nervous about that, but maybe I'm reading between the lines.
Well, no, I mean, Holly says explicitly that the idea of like saving the life of a patient experiencing abortion related complications is like, quote unquote, diametrically opposed
harming her
to why maternal family medicine physicians like became physicians in the first place, that it violates like the fundamental like reason to be a doctor, which is, I guess, only saving life that's valuable to the Christian right.
She said something at one point about a life-based practice of medicine.
Yeah.
Which is like, that's they're collapsing sort of the like religious, political, and medical, like willy-nilly.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
however it serves them.
That's kind of why I feel like I can't say anything coherent about the politics of evidence here, because it's just like, yeah.
I mean, there is something kind of from the other side that is interesting, that like some of the evidence that the lower courts, which, you know, the lower courts, without getting too deep into the weeds of it, are also helmed in this case by deeply ideological anti-abortion judges, both in the first court they brought this to in Texas. Not that any of their physicians have any active practice in Texas where they experience these injuries. Like their only connection to Texas is they chose to incorporate themselves there, because if they did so, they would be guaranteed to go in front of one of these anti-abortion judges. So some of the studies that judge, Matthew Kaczmarek, pointed to in his decision, which was super extreme and went all the way back to 2000. It would have like fully reversed FDA regulations. And that, thank God, or whoever, is not on the table before the Supreme Court technically right now. So right now, like they're looking at winding the clock back to 2016, which is still horrendous. It would kill telehealth. It would reduce the number of weeks at which mifepristone could be prescribed. But you know, his super extreme take was also premised on several studies, alleged studies that have since been
blog
retracted. Right. Yeah. To hear somebody in the Supreme Court refer to anonymous blog posts, I had never heard that one before. That was amazing that we were talking about posting. You know, I think there was sort of like on the sort of more liberal, like quote unquote pro-choice side of the universe, this like belief that like, well, since the studies were junk, that means the legal decisions will be junk, right? And like, so the studies aren't going to save us, I think, on either side here. You know, like this is the political movement that Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine and Alliance for Defending Freedom come out of, like, sees no purpose for the federal government.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, like they see no political legitimacy for any opposing political party. The CEO of ADF, when this case, not when this case was filed, but 2 years before this case was filed, helped draft one of the election denying lawsuits for Trump. Right. So like, this is not they are only going to like marshal equivocal evidence to their side if they think it will help them make the ideological point that they want, which is like, you know, so that, yeah, like it makes it hard to sort of push back on like the level of evidence. But I do think you're hitting on something that is right to be anxious about. And I think maybe to kind of go back around to this question of like how people are covering this and how people are like responding to what happened and trying to make sense of what happened and what the decision might ultimately be. Like, you know, if you as a journalist only cover the Supreme Court, and there are some people who like that's their whole fucking job, you know, and then there are some people who cover like reproductive health, but don't follow politics. Like the media industry is so siloed that I think like those reporters could come to this case and sort of like take away what they want to take away. So there's a way that like hearing even the anti-abortion justices like poke some holes in the arguments brought before them, you could interpret that as like, oh, well, they think this is garbage too. They're not convinced. But I sort of saw it, you know, more as they are just like really hoping that they will be offered like something that they could write in an opinion that like has more weight.
I mean, that's how these things work. As someone who has had to beg a judicial body for access to essential medicines, right? You know, judges say like, listen, you need to tell me what I need to hear, right? Like this is sort of how these proceedings work, right? So for these conservative judges to be, you know, quote unquote, from one perspective, poking holes, right? Which is like, I think a very optimistic way of anticipating sort of what these are, right? From another perspective, you know, they're doing Holly's work for her. And they're making sure that, you know, they can get something or, you know, ask after something that might exist that's citable. They're basically asking for citations in order to construct their opinion around. I mean, this is how the legal system works, right? The judge is there to check the boxes and issue the decision based on interpreting like what boxes the evidence presented falls into, right? Like this is like a basically like a fucking game of chance in some ways that, you know, is actually a performance of personality and politics that we pretend is this like highly neutral, sacred black box that's infallible, right? And that lens like is tremendously powerful and also is sort of central to the mythology of its own power, right? And you have all these people who sort of orient their way that they approach talking about the Supreme Court itself that tries to reify that power. It's such a mindfuck that I feel like you really need reporters like you, Melissa, who are like coming at this from a really specific and explicitly political angle, because otherwise you can't see the forest for the trees, right? There are too many distractions. There are too many rhetorical performances at play and too many norms that you have to see through to even understand like what is the core of what's even at stake here, because the lens of the Supreme Court itself just like automatically translates things into this very sort of disembodied, abstract, like, you know, devoid of urgency suddenly. And it covers for, you know, essentially the kind of heinous and ridiculous actions that are playing out with total, you know, veneer of respectability in a very public way being treated. You know, this is what Alliance Defending Freedom has been doing, is categorically ridiculous clown shit. Karen Holley was arguing before the Supreme Court for the first time, and she did not like even, it doesn't even seem like she like practiced that much. You know, she like, it was just such a mess. And it's so frustrating, I think, for people to see kind of the hypocrisy, right? And think that, oh, if we can catch them in a technicality, right? Like we can beat them at their own game. But the point is that they're playing a game that we're always going to lose.
The best possible read on what was going on yesterday is the conservative anti-abortion justices were saying, like Thomas's first question, and Justice Clarence Thomas got the first question because the first questions are asked in the order of seniority. He typically, up until like the last few years, never spoke, but he had the first question, and his first question was like, well, who would have standing? And I took that to mean like, if we throw this out, can we at least just get in the record who we think could bring this case in the future? Mm-hmm. You know, it felt like who was helping ADF shop for plaintiffs, and ADF shops for plaintiffs. Like, they have a membership based program for churches where they can get counsel from ADF, and ADF can have like a, you know, a listening post into a church so that they can like, oh, you know, your member faced discrimination, quote unquote, because he refused service to a trans person. Like, we're already ready to take your case. Like, it's like Celino and Barnes, or I guess now it's just Celino, but like TV lawyer, you know, like the kinds of like late night, like, you know, mesothelioma ads. It's not that different with the level of rigor that ADF is bringing to this. So that is something to be worried about, that like, even if this fails, they're coming back, and they might come back with something stronger based on the kinds of pushback they got from the justices who are like, want to side with them. And they're just like hoping for a better situation in which to side with them. And I did see some people like lift that up as like a possibility. But the other thing that's sort of absent from some of the responses to it, and I understand why it would be absent, is if like you haven't been paying attention to the way that emergency rooms are already a vector of criminalization.
Yes.
Around miscarriage and abortion. Like, if you
I'm
didn't
so ready
know,
for you to talk to
yeah, that like that nurses are like literally calling the cops on people and putting murder charges, resulting in murder charges being put on them for having a miscarriage or taking misoprostol. Even when we had Roe, if you didn't know that, it might seem like really abstract that like the emergency room is the site of struggle in this case, so to say. You know, why the emergency room? Oh, these concerned doctors. But they know that the emergency room is a very effective sort of funnel point to get people into the criminal legal system for lots of reasons. And they know that like, if they can sort of turn emergency room physicians, nurses, and others into their eyes and ears to prosecute people for their pregnancy outcomes, then that's a win. And so like in that context, like what I was anxious about, and I don't know if this is what you were referring to as well, Abby, is like they're setting up sort of a policing regime inside emergency rooms.
Absolutely. Yes, that's exactly what I'm referring to. Like, I can envision it. I can envision it being added to like the intake forms that you have to do when you come to an emergency room. Like,
yes, facilitation.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
you know, ultimately, you know, they're greasing the lock. They're lubricating the joints, right? They're making the access of criminalization more efficient and optimizing it. And that's, I mean, ultimately, like, as all of your coverage, Melissa, has shown for years now, each of these sort of moments that we've seen, like the Supreme Court actually tackle the web of laws that touch on abortion, right? What we're seeing is like the fine tuning and the expansion and optimization of these means of criminalization and these various pathways of sort of reporting and collecting, starting, you know, databases and lists as the sort of capacity of the administrative state, right? Like facilitating the administrative state in its own destruction to, you know, beef up the surveillance and sort of moral arm of, you know, the kind of administrative state that they want to build, which is a criminalizing state that targets, you know, people who are not using their bodies the way that conservatives want them to.
Yeah, it's already been extremely happening with illicit criminalized drugs.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, this like expansion of criminal, you know, like in pregnancy specifically and criminalization of pregnancy outcomes. And I feel like, yeah. And again, you know, it makes me feel a little bit, I read other coverage about this and I'm like, am I the Unabomber? Like, am I just like a total conspiracy theorist?
No.
You know what I mean? For reading this in between the lines when it's like, oh, but this is about a narrow procedural question about standing and who has standing under article. Like, I don't know. They kept talking about Article 3. Yeah, this is
somebody helpfully summarized it as like, you have to have a legitimate question or controversy. I was like, thank you. Okay. Yeah, that's like, literally, you have to have a problem.
Yeah. Which I mean, I guess these oral arguments have been very instructive on the grounds of like, okay, well, what is the problem here? But it's just like, wow. Like I feel a little bit out of the mainstream. So I'm glad that we're having this discussion and I really appreciate you kind of connecting all these dots for me. I mean, I feel depressed.
I don't think it's an accident either. Like the way that this whole thing is set up is to make people feel like they don't know enough to know what's going on right in front of them.
Yeah. I feel like that, you know, and I study, I have a fucking PhD in like a reproductive health related field. And I often mm-hmm. feel like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the kind of real thing that is being debated, right, is so immaterial, right? Which is just like, again, this question of standing or like, do they have a real thing to argue in court? As you were saying, Melissa, it's a great framing because what they're really saying with the Article 3 stuff is like, is there a justification to like fuck with the regulation here? And yeah. can we crack that open? I mean, they're also asking for like damages in some capacity. It's or not damn. They're asking for some kind of like compensation relief. And relief. And it appears as if the kind of pathway that they're attempting to crack open, right, is one in which, you know, conservatives can finance the kind of gutting of the federal government using federal money in some capacity, right? That there's a kind of, I think, creativity to like the conservative argument that can get confusing also. And I think what we're kind of up against is also a very long process of denial where we mm-hmm. have seen, you know, gradual recognition expand at kind of what's actually at play. And I'm just thinking back to April of last year, Melissa, you know, in some of your coverage of the first time that the Supreme Court's initially getting involved, some of the first Comstock coverage, you write, this case purports to be about the FDA and administrative law. It's really about the end game, banning abortion entirely. And more so than that, you know, the role that Comstock actually plays and the legitimization of the Comstock Act plays in this whole story that we're telling actually gets us to the kind of point of how this is even larger than merely the kind of criminalization of abortion or pregnancy outcomes, but that this kind of spins into a bigger picture of ultimately kind of what is at stake in not just the outcome of this case, but what if the Comstock Act is like successfully sort of revived through the outcome of this case, right? That there is also this kind of larger knock-on effect that comes from that I think is also just, you know, it just seems like there is just like complete like refusal to recognize that. I appreciated, you know, for example, like, you know, Dan Diamond clearly has been reading what you've been writing, right? Because in the Washington Post's live coverage, you have all these people sort of, you know, doing Supreme Court commentary, right? And Dan's just like, yeah, the Comstock Act is really fucked here. Like, this should not be coming up the way it's coming up. This is really mm-hmm. awful, you know? And this is something that I think, you know, you've taught our listeners so much about, Melissa, and Comstock Con is also coming up. Very exciting. But I feel like we really should spend some time on exactly what the updates were, how that sort of conversation is now necessarily going to be informed by what happened in oral arguments this week.
Yeah, I think it's really useful to look back to about a year ago, like as you started, because a year ago, the Comstock Act, it was certainly not in the conversation in the way that it is now after the oral arguments. You know, it was not something that originally came on my radar in the context of abortion at all. Mm-hmm. You know, like when the Comstock Act is thought of at all anymore, it's typically, until this week, maybe thought of as an anti-obscenity law. And it was a much more wide-ranging law than that because Anthony Comstock, the architect of the Comstock Act, his idea of what obscenity is was, you know, as broad as talking about or taking contraception, producing pornography, appearing in public, you know, in a gender nonconforming or lewd manner, abortion, certainly. Like, it all sort of fell under the same umbrella. And it's an umbrella that I think is like quite common to the Christian right and Christian nationalist mm-hmm. ideology that's, you know, animating this case. So on like that level, it shouldn't be surprising. But for people who like aren't nerds about archaic law or people who like weren't sex workers and so like don't have a community history around like this guy's our common enemy. I mean, I learned about the Comstock Act probably from Patrick Califia's book, Public Sex, in like the 90s, in the context of sort of like, you know, this was a guy who was an enemy of all of us. He hated queers, he hated hookers, he hated all of us. So, you know, I don't know that that's where Dan Diamond or Jamelle Bouie or all these other people who have become overnight, we must repeal the Comstock Act people. Thank you, bless. Thanks for showing up. But that is the like the long tail of the Comstock story.
Yeah.
And I would hope that as it becomes more of a live issue, that they like can hold on to that reality and it doesn't just sort of get shorthanded into like a national abortion ban, because it's a lot. The reason that it's alive, though, is because, you know, at some point over the last handful of years, some political minds on the Christian legal right have seized upon the Comstock Act and its banning of mailing anything that could be used for an abortion as a way to go after mailing mifepristone. And I think it's just sort of like ballooned out from there. Like, well, if that's the case, if it's, you know, mailing anything that could be used for an abortion, and like, what about mailing a speculum? What about mailing any medical supplies at all? Mm-hmm. What about mailing a bill? Like, mm-hmm. it's just the web of criminalization is like such a great frame for this. And I think that comes from Miriam Kaba, actually, and her work with Interrupting Criminalization. Like, the web of abortion criminalization like goes far beyond the procedure, and the Comstock Act is like a really effective instrument for expanding that web out to, you know, like, we've got cranks in Texas right now trying to make it illegal to drive through a particular county or city for the purposes of transporting someone for an abortion, mm-hmm. Under the umbrella of the Comstock Act. So I think of it a lot like Roe, and that there was like a real resistance for a long time amongst mainstream and even progressive sort of political circles to contend with the reality that we would not have Roe forever.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of like chicken littling, you know, Cassandra blaming of people who were saying like this is coming. We should be prepared there. Look at them getting the architecture in motion legally to chip away at it. Even by the time we're at SB8, and as you were saying, they were like, I don't know though. You know,
yep.
This is just some crazy thing that people in Texas are doing. And in the same ways that they like minimize Christian nationalism, they minimize the attack on Roe, like minimize Trump, the popularity of Trump. Like I look at the minimization of what the threat of the Comstock Act is in that lens. And it had a second sort of minimization, which is procedural, right? We talked a lot about how like the way that like procedure has allowed a lot of shady shit to happen in the course of this case. And people can argue procedure rather than what's really going on. And people can also pretend the procedure will save them.
Yep.
And so technically the controversy, if there even was one in this case, was not about the Comstock Act. The Comstock Act wasn't being asked to like make any judgment on the application of a Comstock Act to mifepristone or anything. And, you know, they don't need to make that determination to decide this allegedly very narrow question in front of them. And as recently as last week, attorneys were telling me that the Comstock Act would not come up. It was not relevant. It wasn't anything to worry about. And I had, you know, longtime reproductive health advocates, including people who like worked on the original approval of mifepristone, saying like, we've got to clean up our Comstock Act situation because they're coming, you know, like whether or not it comes up in court, they're coming. So even within the universe of people who are paying attention to the politics of abortion, there's just like an unwillingness, I think, to deal with this because it is so ludicrous.
Yeah.
One, but also like technically, no, it wasn't, no one brought this case to like get the Supreme Court to determine the applicability of the Comstock Act, but they started going there, mm-hmm. in oral argument. And the door that they had to go there was the fact that the briefs that were filed in support of the fake doctor organization that came in from like Edwin Meese, former attorney general under Reagan, mm-hmm. architect of the Meese Commission on Pornography in the 80s. Mm-hmm. You know, we had like 145 members of Congress and various other sort of like conservative legal projects, like their fake ACLU, the American Center for Law and Justice or something, all wrote briefs saying that the Comstock Act should be applied to mailing mifepristone. And Meese even said that he thinks that it should be used against patients themselves. So now we're in this like sort of carnivalesque moment where it's like a year ago, only cranks were really talking about this, but the writing was on the wall. Now we have like the conservative mainstream, mm-hmm. saying, yes, this is great. We should do this. And then sort of the cherry on top of that was the questions that came in oral argument yesterday. So like, if you were only following the Supreme Court case and you heard Justice Alito start asking questions about, well, first he didn't even want to refer to the Comstock Act by name. He just referred to it by number.
Mm-hmm.
And then like the Solicitor General who he asked about it, you know, he asked like, well, should the FDA have at least considered 1461, which is the Comstock Act? And, you know, she, to her credit, said Comstock Act. And that triggered, I think, that response from the live bloggers. We're like, what the fuck? Why mm-hmm. are we talking about this? Everyone told us we weren't going to be talking about this. Everyone mm-hmm. told us this wasn't relevant.
This wasn't going to be on the test. This was on the test.
And, you know, and it's very hard to sit in the press section at the Supreme Court when shit goes down, because like you're not supposed to talk. So I just wrote 1461 in giant letters in my notebook and just tried to like contain myself. But like even in the room, once someone said Comstock, the Solicitor General, people were like, what? I was like cats picking up their ears, like shit, something has changed. So we then retreated to several questions, both from Alito and from Thomas, not coming out saying, I believe this. Mm-hmm. But doing like literally just asking questions like, well, some would say, you know, how would you respond to the argument that don't you think you should like stuff like that? And that is the cherry on the top of like, you know, Edwin Meese, 145 members of Congress, right wing conservative law organizations like ACLJ. And this group wasn't doing this a year ago, but they're certainly doing it very loudly right now. The Heritage Foundation and 100 other far right Christian right groups under the auspices of something called Project 2025, which listeners may have come across in other contexts, is sort of this like grand plan for what the next conservative president should do on day one, who he should hire and what policies he should adopt and what can he do just sort of by fiat. And one of the things that this group wants the next conservative president to do by fiat is to immediately begin enforcement of the Comstock Act, or, you know, direct the Department of Justice to immediately begin enforcement mm-hmm. of the Comstock Act. And that, like, the writing has been on the wall, and now, like, the writing is unignorable. Mm-hmm. And I acknowledge that it is, like, completely ludicrous that we are having to deal with, like, the ghost of a man with mutton chops. There was, like, actually a guy who, like, dressed up Comstock outside of court yesterday.
You're kidding.
And had a sign that said like enforce the Comstock Act on one side, and the other side just said let men decide.
What?
So, you know, he was anti Comstock Act.
Oh, that's the picture on your yes. Oh my gosh. I wasn't sure if that was like in seriousness, like, or
no, he committed to the bit with the gray mutton chops and everything. But like,
the ghost
I think
of a man with mutton chops has killed me. Like,
my yeah. God,
this is a terrible person. But I also spoke to some anti-abortion activists who'd come from Texas who had their own little like enforce the Comstock Act signs. And, you know, I'll end on this with my Comstock rant. The one of them was like very mild mannered. And, you know, I asked him if he knew when the Comstock Act had originally been passed. And he was like, well, I don't remember the day, but I think it was like 1870 something, which is pretty right on the money for a rando. And then he was saying that, like, you know, a law is a law. You know, if you disagree with the law, go to Congress and tell them to change the law. And I was like, great, but the law has been on the books for a really long time. So like, why now? And then we somehow got onto the fact that like, he wasn't born when the FDA first approved mifepristone. Oh, God. And then like this guy who was with him, this bigger guy who had like big youth pastor who used to be a quarterback kind of energy, like Kool-Aid manned into the conversation to like start yelling at me. He's like, well, slavery was legal too once. We weren't around when slavery was around. And I was like, okay.
It's like, yeah, turns out some right. laws are kind of bad, I guess. Like, I don't know.
And then he did the like kind of worst case scenario interview with an evangelical Christian, in my experience anyway, after the slavery thing, started trying to like ask me questions, like as if that was going to be this like big revealing trick, because like reporters aren't supposed to have opinions or feelings. Mm-hmm. And so he was like, well, you know, do you know Margaret Sanger? And I was like, oh yeah, I know Margaret Sanger. I think she went to jail because of the Comstock Act. She definitely did. So did her husband. And he was like, well, you know, because of Margaret Sanger and because of that, you know, they can mail Hustler through the mail, and that they can exploit women. How do you feel about that? I like, this is like a galaxy brain argument I've never heard in my life, that like somehow Comstock's prosecution of Margaret Sanger for birth control activism in the 19 teens paved the doorway for mailing Hustler. You know, no one has ever tried, in my experience, and I follow this stuff closely, to blame Margaret Sanger for pornography. But if you have a Comstock mindset, you know, the Comstock grindset, this guy, I could see why you would go there. And in a way, it felt like, okay, this is it. This is the connective tissue. This is all of it right here. This angry youth pastor who's really mad about Hustler and really mad about Margaret Sanger and also really mad about the FDA.
Yeah, well, just tune in to Supreme Court oral arguments like later this year and you'll probably hear it. You know what I mean? Like someone
who's an ADF intern, you know,
like what's her face? Fucking Erin Hawley, I think, kept saying like past is prologue. Oh my God, and I'm like, yeah, you are so right about that, bitch, because I feel like this interaction that you had, I don't know, we're going to see the like official version of this. Dressed up in procedural language, like in no time, I'm certain of it.
Solicitor General Erin Hawley.
God. I mean, you know? Like a year ago, Melissa, when we talked about Comstock Act, you said, and I quote, "Right now, we can take political risks to protect the criminal risks that other people are taking. We don't actually have to wait for the law to catch up. It's not going to. You don't have time." And I feel like, you know, I've actually thought back to that so many times this year, especially in the last couple of months, once I put, you know, the oral arguments on my calendar. And I mean, do you still feel like that's the right sort of way to be thinking about things? Or do you feel like we're in a different place than when we were talking about this a year ago?
I think that sentiment from last year, which so much has gone down, I like completely forgot. So thank you for bringing that back to me. It comes out of like having known folks who worked on abortion funds for a long time. I think that was like sort of the knowledge I was coming into that moment with when, and you know, the moment of Dobbs also, like people cannot stop abortion. People will always need abortion. People will always take risks to access abortion. Like that a judge cannot do anything to fully eliminate that. All of the mythology that's been in the news about mifepristone, you know, regardless, people are still accessing it. And the JAMA study was like so well-timed, you know, if I think some of what they were looking at as well was like access to mifepristone outside the formal medical system. So like looking at community networks, looking at ways that people can access it, you know, without a prescription, that like, I think a lot of the time about sort of the differences and similarities between sex workers movements and abortion rights movements. And the thing in the United States that's really struck me, especially after the last couple of days and seeing how people mobilized around this decision or this oral argument rather, is there is just a level of fearlessness. Like we've had years to sort of build networks of care and community before Dobbs that have been activated and that are caring for people and that are also there for people to like participate in if they're looking for something meaningful to do. That it is actually bridging some of the gap and that it is making a difference. It's maybe making a difference on the level of, you know, we don't have to wait for the law. Mm-hmm. I can't wait for the law. You know, there are people who can't. I was just talking to Nancy Cardenas Pena, who's now with Abortion on Our Own Terms, but has also been the director of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. And, you know, we were talking about the JAMA study the night before oral argument. And, you know, it just feels like it underlined like what this case was really about, that like it is the fear of those networks. It's the reaction to those networks. It's the fact that like the FDA, you know, thanks for showing up sort of on abortion rights. Like you didn't really even have to. And for a long time, the FDA was like over-regulating mifepristone in ways that didn't make sense. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like the FDA is like a big supporter here of access. And the FDA has also long been a target of activists trying to get more access, right? So with or without what the FDA does, with or without what the courts do, people outside of those systems are finding ways to care for each other and it's working. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I do. I take a little more solace in that now, you know, and it's hard to write about. And it's not something I often can write about because sometimes this stuff is also happening within the context of criminalization. Mm-hmm. That has made it harder for people who might not already have sort of a foot in the world of abortion rights movements to access those networks. But, you know, there are abortion funds still operating in states where abortion isn't legal. And there are people who are still doing the work. And like literally nothing that happens in that courtroom is going to change that.
So well put. I know we're bumping up right against on time. And I just wanted before we wrap to just quickly shout out that, you know, ComstockCon is coming up. This is something Melissa, that you and Kendra Albert have been organizing that's going to take place in May in Cambridge, Massachusetts. There's also going to be a way to attend online as well, virtually. There are mask requirements for in-person. And if you do want to attend in-person, there's like a whole application. So folks should go to comstockcon.com and you can find the application and fill out the form there. And we've talked about this a couple of times, but since you guys are now taking applications for attendance, is there anything you want to just like shout out or tell listeners about, you know, in terms of ComstockCon before we wrap today?
It's so fucking weird to be ahead of the curve on this.
I know. Did you plan? I mean, are you excited? You're so on the nose now.
Anyone who's organized a conference knows, like, you know, we started organizing this in like December of 2022, and Kendra and I have been talking about Comstock, you know, long before that. And it's really interesting. Like, week to week, people's understanding of the relevance of Comstock has changed. So even as we've been thinking about who to invite for speakers and like what sort of discourses to respond to, you know, like the original program was like, we are going to have to explain to people why the Comstock Act is relevant. And now it's like, okay, we're going to have to do that, but we're also going to have to respond to some of like the narratives that are developing around the Comstock Act in popular media that just like weren't there, you know, when we started talking about this. So like, I feel like it's not a conference that's about let's repeal the Comstock Act, though that would certainly be great. It is a conference about let's get people together who are part of this broader constituency of enemies of Comstock, as Jules Gill Peterson very memorably put it, and has been in my head, you know, ever since she said it about a year ago in that conversation we've been referring back to. You know, we're not going to solve the problem of the Comstock Act by like organizing around abortion. It's going to take a lot more than that. So that's what that space is for. And it's also a nice antidote to the electoral politics of the moment as well. So I hope people can participate however they can, whether in person or not. And we took our COVID guidelines very seriously and
very seriously.
You know, took inspiration, thankfully, from the Aim for Death panel. The work that you guys did at Socialism has been a template for us. So.
Well, I have to say, yeah, if anyone's looking for a template for some seriously solid COVID guidelines for in-person events, including, you know, this great series of requests that you're, you know, asking all attendees to affirm, like, you know, not just saying you've got to let us know if you're not feeling well, but please just like actually you've got to acknowledge, you've got to wear the mask, you've got to do this. It's very clear. You make it very easy for people to decide whether or not it's like worth to try and attend in person. And that means so much, especially at this point in the pandemic with all the abandonment that we've seen. So thank you for pushing the envelope on that, Melissa.
Of course.
Deeply appreciate it. Oh, well, I think that is the perfect place to leave it for today. Again, if you want to check out or apply to attend ComstockCon, that is comstockcon.com. Patrons, as always, thank you so much for your support. We couldn't do any of this without you. If you'd like to support the show, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod. You'll get access to all of our weekly bonus episodes, including the one that we did on Monday, in which Abby and I break down a recent study that claims that we are overcounting deaths in pregnant people, that uses a lot of the same rhetoric that we've seen applied to COVID deaths and claims that we're overcounting COVID deaths moved into the space of Abby's domain, which is perinatal mortality. It's a great episode. So if you become a patron, you'll get access to that episode and our entire back catalog of patron episodes as a thank you for your support. Again, that's patreon.com/deathpanelpod. And if you'd like to help us out a little bit more, share the show with your friends, post about your favorite episodes, pick up copies of Health Communism or A Short History of Trans Misogyny at your local bookstore or request them at your local library, and follow us at deathpanel_. Patrons, we'll catch you Monday in the patron feed. Everyone else, we'll catch you later next week. As always, Medicare for all now, solidarity forever. Stay alive another week.